I'm only a boy. I don't know how to speak. We heard that this morning from Jeremiah in response to God's call for him to be a prophet. I'm only a boy. I don't know how to speak. This week I prepared a message for today, and I did it in the way that I was trained and have practiced over many years. And then over the last few days, I thought, no. Standard preaching is offering a theological reflection. The preacher has sat with the text, has prayed, has listened, wrestled with the text. What are you saying, God? Preacher stands in a space between the congregation and God in the text and wrestles, and then brings on Sunday thoughts, reflections. And the congregation typically sit there like a Roman crowd, or in modern terms, a consumer. Do I take this? Perhaps I just smell but don't inhale. So this has been kind of niggling at me the last few days. It's my process I'm just sharing here now. And I thought, what this text, I think, is actually talking about requires a completely different approach. And I'm referring to the story we've just heard about Jesus goes to church. Now, I know church is a post-Jewish thing, but he was in a space like this. I've had the privilege of standing in some of the remains, the floor plans of some of the synagogues that Jesus stood in. They're a bit smaller than this. And in the synagogue or in church, there are people doing people stuff. And the scriptures are read. And they are discussed and prayers are offered. So it's quite similar. In fact, a lot of what we do in church is traced back to the practice of the synagogue. That's our way back starting point. So I want to go to the story that we've just heard. He was teaching in one of the synagogues, and you know, you heard the story, you know how it builds. What happened? What happened? I mean, you heard the words, the story that there's a woman set free from an infirmity. She's been bent double, and we'd think with our modern minds, some sort of spinal degeneration, some sort of affliction. And this day in church, Jesus says, "Woman, you're healed." And then he lays, set free, and then he lays hands. So that's kind of the mechanics of what happened. And then there's a reaction, isn't there? And it's that, the chemistry and the dynamic of that reaction that's been pinging in my mind for the last few days. At one level, Jesus goes to church and gets in trouble. Have you ever thought about Jesus as someone who goes to church and disturbs the situation and gets told off? Naughty Jesus. What's that about? Why does Jesus need to be told off? Why does he need to come back and expose what's going on? What's happened to the synagogue? ... What's happened to church? So what's going on here? I don't know if anyone's sparking, full of insight, or you want to spend a minute talking to people or just wonder, where's he going with this? What's coming next? Any big insights, any sort of sense of, I've been over this before, or there's something in this that really speaks to me right now? Anyone? Theo will happily bring you the microphone. We all? Good? Just, there we go, thanks.
Who wants the microphone? It's not turned on.
Great. If we could have those slides sort of handy, Margaret. I'll call on them. Oh yeah, we'll have those two guys up there. What's going on here? If you dive into a commentary, the sort of textual appreciation is that Jesus is Lord of the Sabbath. That's what you've got to take away. But we're not big on Sabbatarianism here, are we? And so that doesn't ring with us so much.
Okay. That
he knew would spark a reaction. Thank you. Okay, so in Kiwi terms, he was stirring. Jesus the stirrer. You might say, oh, hang on a minute, okay, we can't talk about Jesus like that.
It said that Jesus was teaching the church.
I wonder what
he was teaching before he actually did that.
Okay. Bringing a question to the text, great method. What was he talking about? Had his message actually linked to the fact that
I think it was more that Jesus was seeing that there was a need and responding to it than trying to stir up trouble.
Mm-hmm.
I think Jesus saw that there was a need and responded to it and wasn't concerned with what the impact of that would be. Because I think his understanding of the Sabbath was different. So
mm-hmm.
whether he knew that was going to come in conflict or not, I think it was more, here's the need, I'm going to respond.
Okay. You can hear Andrew down there? Okay. Right. Okay, so, yeah. I'll just take those things, because we're thinking together here. And in my sort of method, you know, we ask the question, well, what was happening? What do I need to see? And what does it mean for us? We haven't got to what does it mean for us yet. What's happening? Just this morning, this might have been the Holy Spirit, a line that's often used in Anglican liturgy pinged in my mind. It's from Psalm 51, verse 15. Open our lips, O Lord. We'll try that again. Not because I'm being pedantic, just so that it can be said loudly. If you know it, say it loudly. Open our lips, O Lord.
That our mouths may proclaim your praise.
Okay, great, thanks. Open our lips, O Lord, that our mouth may proclaim your praise. Beautiful. Couplet out of Psalm 51 there. What struck me in this story was that the woman, when she was set free, was praising God in the synagogue. She was alive in church. And the way I translate praising God was she had things to say about the goodness of God. Was she a trained top flight theologian? Don't know. Probably not in that setting and culture. The boys got rabbinical training. Girls were prepared for other things. But she knew, she just had an experience, and she was full of praise. And it's after that that the ruler of the synagogue kicked in and had objections. Jesus, you've upset the situation. Just stay with us, Grace. So, That's what's been pinging for me. Open our lips, O Lord, and our mouth shall declare your praise. This woman starts praising, and she triggers something. These guys have got up there just as kind of, I thought I'd refer to them. Does anyone remember that photo? I preached on this in Europe because I was following the New Zealand media at the time. They're two guys who survived the Christchurch earthquake. They're standing on the Cooper's Librand building. They've just crawled through a hole that was punched in a concrete space. 17 people died in that building. And there they are on the roof. May I say, two Kiwi blokes, hard day at the office. And they let rip. That's praise. They've just looked at death and come out alive. It's an amazing photo. You may remember in Christchurch earthquake, there were two buildings that had a lot of fatalities. This was one of them. I used to go swimming in a pool across the road from there, so it sort of all connected for me when I saw this. I just put that up there as an image of praise. They had something to open their mouths and declare about. So this woman does this in the synagogue, and the ruler of the synagogue is not happy. My Presbyterian friends tell me that they have a blue book of order that they can pull off the shelf and refer to in moments of upset. The ruler of the synagogue does this. There's a history to this. Why is the Sabbath such a big deal? Does anyone know?
It goes back to Genesis. On the seventh day God rested.
Right. But so that's the root of it, Chris. But it's a big deal. There is sort of a whole lot of kind of attention and anxiety attached to this. It's in the history of Israel. So this is just a bit of input here. Because otherwise you say the preacher who just asked a whole lot of questions. I don't know, what was that about? 500 years beforehand, Israel had found itself in captivity and exile in Babylon. And as you do when you're lying on your back with your feet in the air, you think, what hit me? What happened? Where was God in that? If you're a theological reflector. And what Israel concluded, really the people of Judah, in Babylonian captivity, as they sat by the rivers and the canals of Babylon and tried to sing their songs, was they had ignored the Lord their God. They had not kept his commandments. Therefore, God had taken them from the land, put them in exile, and their job was to wake up and remember. And so they remembered, and they resolved, or their leaders in fact resolved, that, you know, what we're going to do now, we're going to observe the law. We're going to really keep covenant. Seriously. And after 70 years, they were returned to the land, and they got back to the land, and that was the lesson. Could I have, there's a picture of a couple of fences there, Margaret. Just keep it going, please. That's the building. There they are again. Oh, there we are. And they took a particular approach to this. You know, if breaking the commandments is such a serious thing, what we should do is set up protective precautions. It's very much like this environment of health and safety that's kicked in the last few decades. So there's a cliff face, I think it's in England somewhere, and there is a boundary fence on the end. That's, you know, don't go past here. Don't. There's danger beyond this. So in relation to the Sabbath, they got thinking and thinking and thinking. No, we need another precaution a few meters further back. And there's the next fence. And just imagine if some meters behind there, I think you can actually see something like that. There's a hedge. Just keep building fences, hedge, barrier. That was the tradition of the elders. Does anyone know roughly how many regulations were developed about the Sabbath?
50.
You're a conservative. Theo said 50. 612 definitions, you know, regulations as to what was work on the Sabbath. And Jesus picks them up on this. You guys say, you know, if you untie your donkey with one hand, you're not working. But if you do it with two hands, it's working. Naughty boy, working on the Sabbath, back to exile. So this is the kind of mindset that's there. It's 500 years in the making, and Jesus arrives, and the day he heals a woman, and this woman opens and prays, all this comes to bear. No. Is there any connection between that and us? Or is this sort of, that was interesting, Francis, let's go home and do lunch. Is there any connection? Because that's what you do. You read the passage, you squeeze it, you read around it, and you ask the Holy Spirit to join the dots. Theo, 21 years old and from Nelson, does this have any application? Can you see any connection? Because I've got one in my hip pocket, you see, but I'm just inviting others out first.
Church can't become too customary.
I'm just saying this for the microphone. Thanks, Ross.
Sometimes we try and contain God in a series of rules, and it's quite a shock when God turns up.
We try to contain God in a series of rules, yep. Both those things I have a comment on.
I don't think we're as restrictive now as we used to be years ago. Hats and gloves and, you know, but that's gone by the by.
Right. There was hats and gloves for ladies, was it?
Yes.
Okay.
When I first came here, I always wore my hat and gloves.
Is that right? How long ago was that? Oh,
sorry. 56 years ago.
In 50, 60 years ago. Okay, so that was woman's attire, hats and gloves. Okay. I've worn gloves in church, you know that. But it's warmed up now, spring's on its way.
That wasn't why
we
wore them.
No. So one of the things that people want, and we're people typically, is stability. Keep it calm. Not too much excitement. Know what to expect. And churches are classic at that. Get us to a steady, set culture. It's good because we know it. And the day something happens that's totally out of the pattern, that rocks the boat, oh! But the thing is, when Jesus went to church, synagogue, that's what happened. He tended to, okay, so what's going on? How do we join all these dots? So this is the thing I've got in my hip pocket that came to me out of this. Open our lips, and our mouths shall declare your praise. I'm only a boy. I don't know how to talk. Just look out when I grow up.
What do we do with our mouths in church land?
Sing.
We sing. Our mouths pour out what our hearts and minds are full of. Our hearts and minds are full of. And praise, whether it's sung or whether it's said, is the overflow, the outflow of what's in us. And here's the thing. My experience of church life and church culture, and I'm going back multiple decades, and it's not just here, is that so really is what comes out of our mouths praise. So really is it really sort of about God, about an experience of God, or even a question about God. And the day this woman found her voice and was giving praise, the ruler of the synagogue found reason to try and clamp down the situation. But Jesus is no slug, and he comes right back. He goes back to Abraham and says, this woman is a daughter of Abraham. Everything that God has promised our people, she's entitled to. And you take more care of your donkey than you do of this woman. And people loved it. They loved it. Don't know what they loved about it. But I think we know when something real is going down, when something life-changing or genuine is happening, and there's a break in the kind of business-as-usual stuff. Now here's the thing. I think it has a lot to do with what we talk about. Now, this kicked off for me when I was 17. When I was 17, I had a big experience of God. I won't tell that story now. But I was at university in Christchurch at the time, and I spent quite a bit of time in the CAF. And I knew a lot of people, and I talked. And all I talked about was what I was learning about God. I had no formal education, no theology, nothing like that. And the number of times people, my peers, would turn to me and say, I want that. Sometimes they burst out in tears, for which I was totally unprepared, emotionally unequipped as a 17-year-old guy. Oh, she's just burst into tears. What do I do now? I don't know. But I saw God at work, and about a dozen friends of mine became Christians, and I'm still in contact with quite a few of them now. I think what God was teaching me, because I hadn't worked this out, was if you talk God, if you open your lips and declare your praise, stuff happens. Now, straight away, you know, I'm aware that some people are described as religious nutters. You go to a party and, well, stay away from her. All she does is talk about God. And there are lots of people who talk about God and aren't smart about it. They just go to strange, extreme, pumped up sort of places. adding a lot of kind of agenda to what they say. But I've found, and I've heard this so often for others, both who've come to faith and been able to lead others to faith, is simply, if you talk about God, you get a hearing. As a kid, I well remember being visited on the driveway of our, what was our suburban home, by a couple of Mormons one morning. And I think it was the 70s, so it was white shirt and bike and, you know, a whole short American haircut package. And these two guys came up the drive, and Dad, my father, talked to them. And my father said afterwards, I was impressed with that man. Now, he didn't become a Mormon, but I heard the conversation, and what he said was he had met God in the temple at Utah. And this is before I was a Christian, but what struck me was he was speaking out of his life. And subsequently, I've learned, you know, they trade a lot on feelings and all that sort of thing. But there is something really compelling about being able to do this. Open our lips, O Lord, and our mouth shall declare your praise. Church and synagogue, whatever, can become really routinized, routine. We meet our friends, we do church stuff, we have coffee, and we limit our praise to the formal agreed bits. So we get a musician up to lead us in songs or something. And that's our praise, right? And this sometimes even gets televised. You can watch Praise Be on Sunday morning. A lot of people doing that. Makes no impact on the world. Squat effect. And even then, even here now, a lot of the songs we sing have been written by others about their experience. And I even question that sometimes. I sometimes think people write songs about what they think the experience should be. What do you think, Theo?
Yeah, true.
Bit plastic.
Very.
But a great bass riff to go with it. And that even makes it worse. We're singing songs about something that we can't relate to, and yet we're owning that as our praise, and that's our praise. Now, open our lips, O Lord, and our mouth shall declare your praise. What I'm getting at is this talking God, both as part of our life together, but then there's an overflow. You're in a staff room situation, aren't you, Andrew, at school? And you're a priest. Okay, so you're a marked man. People know you're a... Sometimes the lingo is you're a God botherer or something like that. Yeah. But just acknowledging God, it can be done so quietly, so beautifully, and if it's... It reflects that our lives are touched and led and shaped by God. So many people, when I was living in Europe, would want to ask me, why did you come? Now, the Dutch in particular, but not only the Dutch, got built-in calculators, just whirring all the time. The cost-benefit analysis is running at top speed. The numbers, the pros and the cons, that's the sort of discussion. Where are you better off in the world? Are you better off there? How good would it be to live in Australia? And lots of people would ask me those sorts of things. And then they'd ask me, why'd you come here? And I just say, call of God. Oh. And half of them would want to know more, and the other half would head off back to the cost-benefit analysis as quick as possible. Just to talk about God as real and actually alive in your life is a threshold that changes everything. It changes the conversation, it can change the relationship, but like I said, it does either one of two things. People change the subject as quick as possible. I've had this at wedding tables and such like, where you're across a table and someone suddenly realizes you're a vicar. They want to change tables. You know, God can be quite scary. They think they've got a religious fanatic across them or something. And the other half say, just like on the day of Pentecost, tell me more. Tell me more. So, are there any other pictures in that lot, Margaret? What else have we got? Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Taraparaha. Paul, preaching to the Athenians in Acts 17, very smart, says, quote some of the Greek prophets. I was thinking about this just yesterday. I thought there's a line from a prophet. Sorry, a poet, not a prophet. A poet that was relevant here. So, Taraparaha, from memory, Ngāti Toa, left a big trail of destruction in the South Island, just down the road from where I grew up, Kaipoi here. He's credited with a haka, but I read around it yesterday, and that some say the haka existed, or this line, before. And it's pretty popular because, there we go, the All Blacks used it for a long time. Now, where'd the mic go? Could you give the mic to Andrew, please? Because your te reo is probably better than mine. Could you just read that for us?
Kamati, kamati, kaora, kaora. Kamati, kamati, kaora, kaora. Tene te tangata, uura, uura, nana.
I could hear the as you were saying that. All right. Does anyone know offhand what the translation is?
Yeah.
You do?
It's about he's hiding in a pit and.
Yeah. Could you give him the mic, please?
It comes from hiding in a food pit and having an old courier sit on top of it while people are hunting him. And so when he says Siti Tera, he's talking about. But kamani kamani kaora, it is death, it's life, it's life. And it's all about hiding from his enemies and survival.
Yeah, thank you. This is a mean trick to play on you, Chris, but there's the English translation. So, I got this from Pihupa Mura Walters many, many years ago. So he's been chased in the North Island somewhere, Te Ika a Maui, and he hides in a kumara pit, and the British troops run over the top. And it's a moment, it's a powerful moment. He says, I was dead, I was dead. Now I'm alive, I'm alive. You can feel the energy. It's haka material, isn't it? And beside the pit was sitting an old hairy man, I thought. And he marvels at this moment that this man sitting here as a decoy for the British troops who didn't find him. But it's this powerful kamate, kamate, kaora, kaora. I was dead, I was dead. I'm alive, I'm alive. That's praise. That's acknowledging a moment. Now he doesn't relate it to God. But it's a powerful confession, a powerful telling forth of a defining moment in his life. And isn't it amazing the place that has been given in our national culture? It's the stuff, it's the thing to do. And even just, you know, talking about our lives in conversation, but then linking it to God, it's powerful stuff. Doing that in the synagogue that day got Jesus in trouble. Of course, he created a situation that the woman had something to praise God for. But if she'd kept quiet, everything might have been different. So to really boil it down and to end, because I haven't written this out, and the thing about preaching is that I was taught you've got to know how you're going to end, otherwise you just dribble on for hours. Maybe that's happening already, something. Here's the thing. I would like to encourage us to talk more life, more God. We can talk the price of fish, we can talk politics, we can talk all that stuff, but you can do that at the golf club too, or the bridge club, or wherever. This is a place to talk life, and life in God. And there's a sort of a little phrase that's come into the culture in the last half century or so. It's from therapy and counseling and such like. But I statements. That's an I statement. I was dead. This was death. I'm alive. Daring to make I statements, to relate out of your own life, out of your own experience. That's one thing. Because that's what's interesting. But really, in God's service, relating that to God, giving it theological significance. And my experience in life is God uses this. Now, it's not setting us up to be preachers, it's not setting us up to be undercover Billy Grahams or evangelists or to have positions on morals or anything like that. No, don't go there. Don't go there. There's far too much of that aloft already. But with each other and those we relate with, talk about your own life and God in that. Give God praise when and where we can. So that's where I got to in this. Is anyone else sitting there thinking, I've got a diamond of an insight in this passage, and he hasn't said it? Okay. My question, and I'll leave it as a question, is can we do this? Can we do this? And most of you are, well, I'm 61, but you're sort of plus or minus that somewhere. This might be something entirely new. You might have been told your whole life, you don't be too forward about yourself, or you keep your own life to yourself. Just talk about the price of fish and the weather and kick tires and rugby and all will be well. So this might be an adjustment or a change.